Good morning, Your Honors. If it may please the court, my name is Greg Roosevelt and I represent Carla Boston, counsel. This court hears a case regarding Ms. Boston, who is a longtime employee of Granite City Steelworks of the U.S. Steel Corporation. She had worked for 18 years in the engineering department. Her supervisor, her boss, the head engineer, Tom Kernan, has given an affidavit in which he clearly stated that Carla Boston was a high-performing employee during those years, worked directly with him. She had good skills in detail work, which is inherent in engineering, and also in computer work, which is an important part of that function. In the Great Recession in 2008, Ms. Boston was laid off, as well as all other employees of the Granite City Steelworks. She was required then to bid back to positions as a union employee, which she was. The three bids in question are what we're here about. In the first instance, she went through a bidding process, was disqualified in the basic oxygen furnace. She filed a complaint with the EEOC, her belief that she was discriminated based upon age and sex. And this, she was disqualified, the EEOC complaint was made, and that was in 2010. Later, or about then, later, within a year, she bid in the pass control function and was disqualified. The third instance, she bid in the ironworks and was disqualified there on January 10 of 2012. The district court found that the training that she went through was a sham. District court initially denied summary judgment to defendant's motion. A motion to reconsider was filed.
District judges don't make findings on summary judgment.
Exactly, thank you. But his decision was to deny the motion, simply. And he stated in his rationale in the order, and he viewed the evidence most favorable to us at that point, in that it's not a judicial determination on the merits, but instead his conclusion on summary judgment. And following this, he had a couple issues they're presenting. First, in the last disqualification, Marcia Graham. Did Ms. Graham act within her authority? Was she on a lark or when she did the disqualification process? She was assigned by her supervisor, Ms. Fields, to do the training. The training was, and she and the supervisor, Ms. Fields, who headed up the ironworks, was clearly reporting Graham, according to her testimony, daily to Ms. Fields on the training and how it was going. Notes were being kept daily on the training. Ms. Graham testified that she never kept notes where she trained other individuals. This was an exception. This was different in character. Next, she kept and retained a telephone message for evidence potentially later. She told Carla Boston, Ms. Graham, that I don't care what you filed. A co-worker gave an affidavit stating that she overheard Ms. Graham and another worker discussing the EEOC filing. We clearly believe that the function she was performing was within her duties. It was a job assigned to her by the manager, Ms. Fields. It was within the time and in the location that she was to be performing those duties. And it clearly met the test of at least in part under the Badgent case, the Illinois Supreme Court, being at least in part for the purpose of serving the master, serving the employer. Clearly, Ms. Graham was doing the work assigned her. The district court, in its order, raised the concern of a lack of proof that Ms. Fields actually knew what was going on, that there was a retaliatory motive involved, that there was some intent. I believe here we have to look at whether or not the excuse given in all three disqualifications, which included a lack of computer expertise. Ms. Graham testified that she couldn't even allow the employee to get on the computer because she was so improficient, so unable to perform function of operating that computer. So she was denied computer access repeatedly. This was, again, what led it being characterized as a sham. The expert who was a trainer in the case, Ms. Zabel, testified as totally inconsistent with proper training practice. The training itself was then infirm in all three instances. When we look at a misjudgment of the capabilities of this employee, that goes to the question of pretext. Pretext was present here in that a characterization of a failure to be able to do the computer work is totally inconsistent with what Tom Kernan, who headed engineering in a department in the same facility for the same type of steel production plant, that same plant for 18 years was doing the computer work in engineering, and now all of a sudden can't do it. Look at the second instance of the disqualification. Ryan Cunningham, again a manager. Mr. Cunningham had the Ms. Boston.
Actually, the only return to layoff status that's properly before the court is the 2012, which is the last one, and that's the only one that is within the limitations period. So it doesn't really matter what happened before. What we need to know is what is the state of the record concerning the decision maker's motivation in connection with the 2012 return to layoff status. And that decision maker was Fields, right?
It was, Marcia Fields. And we're looking at a pattern of conduct going
back
to...
This isn't a hostile work environment claim. This is a claim for a discrete act of retaliatory discharge or removal to a return to layoff status. So we have to know what was Ms. Fields... What is the evidence of Ms. Fields' retaliatory motive in 2012 when she made the decision to return your client to layoff status?
Ms. Fields was a manager. She knew what had been going on. She was part of
Is there any evidence that she knew of your client's past EEOC activity?
What she had to have known is...
Well, what is the evidence that she knew? Do we have any evidence that she knew?
It would be from Ms. Graham, who testified directly that she met with her daily. Ms. Graham saying, I know what you filed. I don't care what you filed. Ms. Graham having a co-worker conversation with some other employees about the EEOC filing and the fact that they departed from their normal practice at Ms. Fields' direction and keeping the notes and preserving that tape. And the evidence for pattern or intent, I believe the court can go back and look at what occurred in three events in the same facility over the same EEOC filing are all relevant to show intent in the misjudgment.
Well, just to follow up on what Judge Sykes said so that I understand, Mr. Rosso, you say the record is clear that Ms. Fields was aware of the Graham conversations with...
That would have to be a circumstantial, Judge, from an inference that they had met and had spoke. Ms. Fields did call Ms. Boston when she announced the discharge and said, look, I understand I am reminded that I am to make a decision on discharge today. Someone was speaking to her, and she wasn't living and working in a vacuum in that environment. I think it's reasonable to conclude from the pattern that it was part of just that. Thank you for your consideration.
Mr. Hetledge?
May it please the Court. I'm James Hetledge, and I have the pleasure of representing United States Steel Corporation, the appellee in this case. This case has two claims, a retaliation claim under Title VII and the ADEA, and an intentional infliction of emotional distress claim. Judge Sykes, I think you hit one of the nails right on the head when you were noting, what is this case about? What action do we have that's at issue here? And it's one discrete act. It's one discrete act that occurred on January 10, 2012, when the plaintiff was disqualified from her ironworks position.
And what is the state of the record regarding any cat's paw theory that Graham was manipulating Fields?
I don't think that a cat's paw theory can be achieved. First, plaintiff's counsel asserted that the employer knew, that Fields knew, that Fields must know. Those are all in appellant's brief, and we drew attention to the fact that there is no citation to the record for any of those statements. Those bold conclusions are not supported by the record. There is nothing that would suggest that Ms. Fields knew that in 2012 that a charge of discrimination had been filed 15 months earlier. Further, as to Ms. Graham, I don't think the cat's paw theory applies. This court found the cat's paw theory, and it's been discussed multiple times. First, plaintiff's counsel in their brief relies on the Supreme Court case of Staub, but that doesn't apply here because that case is only limited to where the non-decision maker was in fact the plaintiff's supervisor. But secondly, to pursue the cat's paw theory, the two things must be proven. Two things must be proven by the plaintiff. One, discriminatory motive by that non-decision maker, and secondly, the causal relationship between the non-decision maker's alleged illicit motive and the employer's adverse action. There is no support for that here. All we have is one speculative conclusion by plaintiff and counsel that a statement that Ms. Graham denies she made, but we are here on summary judgment. She denies she made that, but the statement, when looked at in full context, was much broader. It's not just, I don't care what you filed. It is, I'm not going to train somebody so the next time that we get laid off, I get laid off. I'm not training a union person for that. And then she allegedly said, I don't care what you filed. That's plaintiff's own testimony as to what Graham said. I believe what was said is, I don't care what you file, implying if she files a grievance. But that alone is wholly insufficient to meet the burden of the cat's paw theory for Title VII retaliation. If one looks at the cat's paw theory, and this court has multiple times addressed the various factors that are required to achieve the circumstantial evidence to have that convincing mosaic to somehow find the improper intent, the facts here, the record here, doesn't support it. There is no suspicious timing. We're talking 15 months between the charge being filed and the disqualification. There are no ambiguous statements. The only statement allegedly made by Graham is explained by plaintiff herself in her deposition and is explained by Graham in her affidavit that shows she was talking about, I really don't want to train my replacement. That's certainly a reasonable basis to not want to train someone, and that doesn't show a retaliatory animus under Title VII or the ADEA. Further, no bits or pieces, there's nothing else. There is nothing else that ties to Graham's actions specifically related to the 2011-2012 training in Ironworks. The second theory is whether there's evidence of similarly situated employees being treated differently. Graham trained a number of employees. Graham trained them all. Boston just didn't grasp the training. She didn't work out. That happens at times. It's unfortunate, but it happened. The fact that Graham started taking notes with respect to Boston's not getting it with respect to the training in the December, January timeframe, that doesn't mean she was treating this person differently than the rest. She just was being a good employee and making some notes as to what her concerns were. Her job was to train. Further, plaintiff makes no showing that there are other recalled employees who hadn't filed charges that weren't also disqualified. So what we're really getting to is not the scope of the training, but the disqualification. That's her complaint. It's in her charge of discrimination. It's in her complaint. Really, the only thing she complains about, she talks about the date of the discriminatory action or the retaliatory action, January 10, 2012. Only that one thing happened that day, and that was the disqualification.
By Ms. Fields.
By Ms. Fields.
Ms. Fields, did she rely on Ms. Graham's notes?
The evidence does suggest that at least Ms. Graham and Ms. Fields spoke. They spoke on the day of January 10. I don't know whether she handed the notes. I assume Ms. Graham took the notes with her. That'd be the purpose of the notes. But it's a legitimate business reason. Really, what we have here and what this court has seen before is the Title VII blender theory. And I'm not going to repeat it, but is recognized by in the court case of Volovsek versus Wisconsin Department of Agriculture. They've thrown it all together. They've placed the blob in front of the court, and they hope to win. That's insufficient. The second claim that the plaintiff does try to assert is an intentional infliction of emotional distress claim. The elements are clear. The state court, Illinois state court, has repeatedly set out the elements, and the plaintiff can't prove the majority of them. As cited by the case in Ulm versus Memorial Medical Center, the elements are that U.S. Steel engaged in extreme and outrageous conduct toward plaintiff. It's not there. There's nothing extreme or outrageous. The only allegations made by the plaintiff are that Graham would play loud music in her office, an office in an ironworks factory, played music. That Boston's desk was messy the first day she arrived. That Graham felt uncomfortable that Boston couldn't handle the computer aspects and therefore had Boston work on her computer and not her own computer because of the risk, significant risk, to the company if Ms. Boston messed it up. U.S. Steel, second element, U.S. Steel intended or recklessly disregarded the probability its conduct would cause plaintiff to suffer severe emotional distress. There is no showing at all that U.S. Steel intended to cause Ms. Boston emotional distress. Plaintiff's counsel instead wants to argue that in this employment setting, because Ms. Boston cherished her job, I'll tell you what, I cherish my job. I don't want to get fired. My family depends on me to earn income. And that's true for just about every person who's employed. Just because you want to hold on to your job, that doesn't raise that standard where the employer knows, if I fire you, then I've intended to cause you emotional harm. Further, the last element, U.S. Steel's conduct actually and proximately caused plaintiff's distress, there is no showing of that. In this case, there are two theories. The district court properly granted summary judgment. True, it was on a reconsideration, but properly granted summary judgment. There's no basis for cat's paw theory. There's no basis for retaliation by Ms. Fields, and there's certainly no intentional infliction of emotional distress. The court has no further questions. I'll stand on my brief, and I hope that the court will affirm the summary judgment below. Thank you.
Mr. Russell?
Thank you, Your Honor. Ms. Graham and her explanation that she could not even allow Ms. Boston to get on the computer on her own, to learn it, to familiarize herself, is clearly pretextual. Mr. Kernan, the head of engineering of the same employer, clearly states that she had computer skills. It's entirely consistent also with Boston's experience with Bechtel Corporation in the near term on a rebuild where she was doing computer work. Also, it's really important that no one else was of the applicant's notes were taken on. This is a complete departure from practice. The explanation given was pretextual, without a doubt, on the computer skills. The evidence is replete under Chloe with the statements regarding knowing about the EEOC filing and also, I don't care what you filed. That direct statement, it was an administrative assistant to an administrator that was involved. IIED, there, Dr. Jewell clearly states that this lady suffers from depression and from anxiety disorder as a result of what happened to her here. You can go back to those prior instances. This was her career. There was all the power in the relationship. The Illinois Supreme Court has said this employment policy issues in the Davis Supreme Court case is appropriate for IIED cases, particularly in the employment section, and this was part of a pattern of conduct where even one incident on its own may not be sufficient, but where it's a series of incidents that occur clearly is. Respectfully, thank you for your time and hearing.
Thank you, Mr. Rosa. Thank you, Mr. Hubbard. The case is taken under advisement.